Bloomington's disability community introduces itself to the new city council. A new rule is proposed by the United States Department of Transportation concerning passengers with disabilities who travel via airline. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration renews a campaign banning a device long used in a Massachusetts institution, and we talk with Bloomington Human Rights Director Michael Shermitz on the latest developments in Bloomington disability policy. Good evening, I'm Abe Shapiro, and this is Disabilitin, where we cover the top stories impacting the disability community across the country and around the world. Good evening, and a brief reminder that April is Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month. In local news, new members of the Bloomington City Council were introduced to disability rights organizations in the city for the first time last Wednesday. Leslie Davis, chairperson of the Bloomington Council for Community Accessibility, a volunteer organization working with businesses and the city government, was the first to speak.
We assist with accessibility surveys for polling stations, schools, restaurants, and retail stores. We work toward creating community awareness of the challenges of a society that has long undervalued community accessibility. The main reason we wanted to meet with the City Council is so that you remember to think of the 25% of the U.S. population that has some type of disability. So please think of and include people with disabilities in the decision-making process in all areas of civic life that involve you as city councilors or you as community members. So please use us.
Davis was then followed by Karen Willison, co-president of the Mobility AIDS Lending Library.
Many people with disabilities or injuries struggle to get the mobility equipment they need. Often their insurance won't pay or their device broke and they're told it will take months to get it repaired, or maybe they just need a mobility aid temporarily, and that's where MAL comes in. MAL collects donated mobility aids and distributes them to people who need them free of charge. Through our partnership with the Monroe County Public Library, any member of our community can go to the downtown branch during business hours and get a free cane, crutch, walker, or rollator. We also have wheelchairs, power wheelchairs, mobility scooters, shower chairs, and all kinds of other equipment available by appointment at our outside storage location. Unlike library books, there's no due date. You can keep it as long as you need it. So we're encouraging everyone who may have durable medical equipment, such as canes, walkers, wheelchairs you don't need anymore, to reach out to us. We'd love to give it to someone who needs it.
Council President Isabel Piedmont-Smith asked organization members about whether progress had been made to upgrade sidewalks in the city to ensure safe passage for Bloomingtonians in wheelchairs. Bloomington Human Rights and Government Liaison for the Bloomington Council for Community Accessibility, Michael Shermitz, responded.
We've been discussing that, and there has been thoughts about trying to paint a designated area where people should put their bins in or some kind of placement, but not much has been progressed on that since the idea came up. But I know it's still under consideration. It just hasn't moved forward in terms of anything positive happening on it.
Councilmember Kate Rosenbarger then spoke about the importance of working with disability organizations to improve sidewalks in the city, in particular how to do so with sidewalks already designated as historical.
I want to look at any other things in the city that need to be undesignated so that people with accessibility issues can walk and roll on them. So I would love to work with the Council on Community Accessibility to develop that list.
In news from the federal government, a new rule was proposed in February by the Department of Transportation to improve how airline staff nationwide handle wheelchairs for travelers with disabilities, a rule first introduced by Department Secretary Pete Buttigieg last July. But on February 29th, the rule was announced in its final form. This is the latest development by the Department of Transportation to make airlines more accessible, with the department having drafted a Bill of Rights for disabled airline passengers in July 2022, the first such document in American history. While the Airline Carriers Access Act of 1986 already prohibits airlines from discriminating against passengers with disabilities, it seems more enforcement is needed. In data obtained from the Department of Transportation released last month, a total of 11,527 wheelchairs were, quote, mishandled, end quote, an increase from 2022 when the total was 10,449. The new rules tackle three areas: penalties, assistance, and standards of airplane construction. Under the penalties section, any airline mistreating a wheelchair has violated the Air Carrier Access Act, which may result in the Department of Transportation levying, quote, penalties against said airline, end quote. The section goes on to state that in the event of a wheelchair being damaged, the airline in question must inform the impacted passenger that it will pay for their wheelchair's repair within a, quote, reasonable time frame, end quote, whilst providing the same passenger an option to borrow a wheelchair in the meantime. In national news, since its founding in 1971, the Judge Rotenberg Center in Canton, Massachusetts, has served as an institution for individuals with disabilities. To help patients stop dangerous behaviors, the center uses aversive therapy, in which a patient experiences a form of discomfort given by a therapist if a patient engages in perceived inappropriate behaviors. The goal is for the patient to recognize that continued occurrences of such behaviors will result in further exposure to discomfort, leading them to stop the behavior. But the center is the only institution in the country performing aversive therapy with a device known as the Graduated Electronic Decelerator, or GED. The device is usually worn by a patient on their bodies, and if the patient exhibits behaviors the staff deems inappropriate, an electric shock is given via remote control. The center states the device is only used as a last resort if a patient continues to engage in, quote, self-injurious or violent behavior, end quote, after prior attempts at prevention have failed. But several incidents at the center have come to light, demonstrating that usage of the device is not only ineffective at reducing harmful behaviors, but it has left lasting physical and psychological damage on patients and is often used as an initial form of treatment. At this time, the device is permitted for 45 to 50 patients at the center, according to representatives. Despite the United Nations classifying the device as a form of torture in 2013, legislative efforts to ban the center from continuing to use the device have been unsuccessful, with a Food and Drug Administration ban of the device in March 2020 being overturned by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in 2021, on the grounds that the ban went beyond the department's authority. In 2022, Congress passed the Food and Drug Omnibus Reform Act, expanding the FDA's authority to, quote, ban devices that can be used in situations proven to cause substantial and risk of illness or injury, end quote. And just this week, the Food and Drug Administration unveiled a new attempt at a ban on the devices. According to a statement issued by the department's Product Evaluation and Quality Office, the director, Owen Ferris, said, quote, these devices present a number of psychological risks, such as depression, anxiety, worsening of underlying symptoms, development of post-traumatic stress disorder, and physical risks, such as pain, burns, and tissue damage, end quote. On May 28th, the department will close public comment on the rule, at which time it will decide whether or not to proceed with the ban. You're listening to Disabulletin here on WFHB 91.3 Bloomington, Indiana. Our next story in a moment. Today I'm joined by Michael Shermis. He enforces the requirements of national disability legislation, and he joins us today to discuss the latest legislation that passed the Bloomington City Council, Ordinance 2331. It requires closed captioning in places of public accommodation in the city, such as bars, restaurants, what have you. Could you give us a lowdown on the ordinance and what the goal of the ordinance is?
Yeah. Let me give you a historical context for it, too.
Sure.
Because there's a kind of two parts in terms of my role in it. So the Council for Community Accessibility has long wished to make a better connection to the deaf community. And a lot of people who are deaf don't see themselves in the same world because they don't have to fight for physical accessibility in terms of right of way or streets or restaurants or anything like that. So it's been a hard connection to make. But I knew some people in the community, and when one of them came to me, I had worked in with her in another context. She is now the legislative chair for the Indiana Association of the Deaf. And she said, so we have been trying to get this closed captioning requirement done nationwide. It's been a real struggle. So they're moving it to states in the effort to try to get the state to do it. And essentially, we've been pretty much rebuffed by the Indiana state legislature in terms of trying to get them to do any kind of ordinance or anything like that. So she said our next strategy was let's go local. And she said, I live in Bloomington, so I'd like to see about us passing an ordinance like this. And I said, sounds fantastic. I, like many other people I know, use closed captionings. I'm not necessarily hard of hearing, but I frequently can't understand things because of the swell of the music, or they mumble, or there's accents or whatever. And I find that it is just way better to have captioning on. So I have it turned on all the time. So I'm like all over it. And I said, great. Why don't you present to the Council for Community Accessibility, because they're the first place to start to get them behind it. And she was okay with doing that. It was not very long after that where we agreed that this was an ordinance that we would want to start pursuing. She started to work on a draft of it. And then we started discussing enforcement. And the concept at that time, which has been done in other cities, was to use a method to fine people for not having their TV turned on. Bloomington's not really that kind of community where they fine. And so it was a little bit of a struggle. And it came down to, like, maybe that's not the right route to go. And after much consideration, we said, what we prefer to do is just treat it like any other discrimination complaint. And if somebody make a complaint, we'll go investigate it, which probably would mean going to the place that it was not turned on and saying, you need to turn this on. If they refused, then we would do it as official human rights complaint. And conveniently, I'm the director of the Human Rights Commission in the city of Bloomington. So I gave it to myself, and we took it to the Human Rights Commission and said, so here's this ordinance, and we want your recommendations, since all enforcement would come to this group, this commission. We want to make a suggestion that this ordinance be moved to city council. So we batted it around for a while, agreed on things, got the language suddenly tight. Then we got a city council member, Steve Olin, to be our champion in essence, and work with us to hammer it out and finalize it and agree on it. And they ended up taking it to the city council. We presented, came, talked to them, and it got passed.
I imagine it must be pretty difficult, regardless of what area you're in the United States, regardless of population, regardless of the size of the disability community. How does one go about taking down statistics for convincing others to pass such an ordinance?
That, of course, was an early question. How many complaints have you got about this? And I'm like, well, we haven't got any complaints, but that doesn't mean that if it were then turned into a law that more people would start following it, because people don't voluntarily do things that mean they have to actually take an action. Look at the ADA. The ADA, unfortunately, does not have much bite to it. It is extensive in what's you're supposed to do, but it doesn't give much of a way to actually make people do it other than private individuals suing. And that is not a great way to enforce a law, but that is unfortunately the way it works. So no statistics saying you should do this, but we know that if you do a law, then people are going to start following it because they don't want to be in trouble. And so for us, it's more about education. So let's educate people that this is a helpful thing to do, not just for the deaf, but for people hard of hearing, for all sorts of people. If you're in a place where it's loud or noisy, you can't hear what's coming on the TV. You can just have captions on, and you can be able to read it well. And I don't think we're going to get all that much resistance, especially if we go about educating the community in the right way. And we just recently talked about that and have some definite strategies on how to roll it out so that they do get educated, and it's an easy ordinance to deal with.
I wanted to ask, too, especially with guidelines and the ADA, What are the current guidelines for closed captioning, at least in the context of the Americans with Disabilities Act?
It's not required at all. There's nothing in the Americans with Disabilities Act that says that it's required. It has to be done locally or by state. There's never been any a great push to get it passed federally that's been successful. So it just has to be done by local ordinance. And fortunately, we're progressive enough here in Bloomington to get it done.
Yeah. And I also wonder as well about the idea of undue hardship, which I know is a very common place for businesses to run if they believe it might not be financially sound enough for them. How do you approach businesses in Bloomington who may get nervous about the prospect of closed captioning or who might say it's too pricey? Well, we're not sure. What do we do? You know, how can you help those businesses adjust?
Right. Well, I mean, it ain't too tough is one thing I'm going to say. I mean, turning closed captioning on is just a few clicks of the of your remote to be able to turn it on. It's not hard at all to do. And what we're going to try to do is have a trifold brochure that if we go physically into a place and it's not on, we hand it to them and say, you actually need to turn this on. Do you need any help or assistance doing it? Because it's not really hard to be able to do. Most of them wouldn't want you to do it. They would do it themselves. So we're not really worried about more people adhering to it. I think that if we do some good publicity, get some articles in, say, Bloom Magazine and the Herald Times and in other radio stations, that if we start doing that, businesses are going to follow it. We also have the collaboration with the Chamber of Commerce, who will let all of their members know about this ordinance passing and that it needs to be followed. And another great partner is the AARP, so American Association of Retired Persons, and that will make a difference having them also try to spread the word. And I think we'll get the publicity out there, and I think that once the publicity is out, that it will just naturally follow, that people will do it. I don't think it's a big of a hardship as the physical accessibility, because so many places are so much less physically accessible that it requires much more money and time to deal with, and this is just not a big deal. That's what I hope, anyway. We'll see.
Well, it definitely sounds like it's still in the early push at the moment. I mean, I definitely can see passage is just the first step and that there is still a ways to go, I am sure. I guess the real question is, how is implementation going so far? Have businesses already signed on? Who's signed on in particular?
I mean, there was an article in the Herald Times soon after it passed, like in mid-January. Somebody in there, they had quotes on both sides, one saying, I don't think it should be a law. Part of me wants to say, well, too bad, it already is. There were other people who said, gee, it's just the right thing to do. When you go into bars and restaurants, and I do frequently, I'd say 2/3 of them have their captions on already, so that it's not going to be that big of a deal. But there obviously is going to be some education. I think that big box stores, like Target, Best Buy, a place like that, will have to adjust because they have walls of TV, and you have to have one in every five has to have the captions on. I think that fitness centers, who you can go to those and you can see 60 TVs because if they have one all over. And I would say it's way less than one in five currently at most fitness centers have their captions on. So I think that they have some education to happen there too. And we'll see how it goes. But I'm going to be confident that people will start doing it soon.
And you mentioned that you had been in partnership with other states in pursuing this legislation?
Well, not other states.
Or
we talked to the people in Seattle, and they said they get good adherence to their passage of it. They've only had a couple fines, not very many complaints over the last year or so that they've had it done. We did talk with them and asked them about how they got their ordinance passed and what issues went through. This was with the Chamber of Commerce representative, Christopher Emge, and Stephen Boland was there, as well as people from the Council for Community Accessibility and Holly Elkins, the Indiana Association of Deaf Persons. So people were there. We listened. We came back and crafted our own. So we looked at some others. The Holly was kind enough to provide us with information where other cities had done it, and we had some of that to go by too. So we looked at lots of other cities, but that's mainly what we did.
Do you think that this can trickle down? Do you believe that there is another county that could be open to it? What is Monroe County, or what is the Bloomington CCA's next step in terms of getting awareness out?
Yeah, well, in the city, which is what we're responsible for, we will be doing a lot more to educate people. Sending out mailings, getting press releases going, having a brochure available, giving it to all of our Council for Community Accessibility and Bloomington Monroe County Human Rights Commission, and saying, "Hey, you should pass this out." Now, this ordinance is just for the city. The enforcement arm of the Bloomington Monroe County Human Rights Commission extends to the whole county, except for the unincorporated areas of Ellisville, Steinsville, and not Indiana University, because they're a state organization or funded by the state, and so we can't investigate anything from the state. Beyond the city, we were not responsible for it. I will say that when we go to conferences at the state and national levels, we talk about it. 5 or 6 years ago, I presented at the Governor's Council for People with Disabilities and told them about our accessibility decal program, which surveys local businesses and retail stores for accessibility. And once I started talking about that at the state level and doing a presentation, other people said around the state said, "Gee, we don't do this. Can you come and talk to us?" And so I've been to 5 or 6 cities now talking to them about what it is that we do. I think the closed captioning might mirror that. We'll act as a model and tell people how we did it, and hopefully they'll follow our lead. We'll see.
And I know you mentioned that there is already legislation in Bloomington about this. How would this legislation impact it? What would you say makes this legislation a little bit more distinct or similar to legislation that's come before?
There's not much else on the books in terms of local legislation that has anything to do with disabilities. The Human Rights Ordinance, which the Bloomington Monroe County Human Rights Commission is responsible in force, does discrimination, which includes disabilities, as one of the protected classes. And so we would respond to that. So when there is an ADA issue of various types, that would come to me first. I would field it. Many of the issues are, let's say, just quickly resolved by me going out and talking to the, doing something wrong in the sense that they haven't made something accessible. I will frequently just investigate it and explain people what they need to do. In more serious cases, when they have a complaint, then we'll work it up as an official complaint and we will do a formal investigation. Most of the complaints are not about physical accessibility as much as people with disabilities having the issue of feeling they've been discriminated because of their disability, having to do with employments. There's some public accommodation, and but a lot of it's around housing, kind of stuff like that. And some of that may have to do with physical things, but sometimes it just has to do with I have a disability and feel like I'm being mistreated for my disability in various different ways. But it doesn't have to do with something that we can really sink our teeth in and say, you have to change this. It's more discrimination-oriented. So that's really the only legislation that's out there to deal with that other than the ADA.
But what does an ADA investigation really look like? I know you said you investigate, then it builds up to a complaint.
Well, for us locally, it will literally be a person complains that there's not captioning, deaf or not. If they say there's not captioning at this place, they will let us know. My first step would be to go and see if the people would voluntarily turn on captioning. If they refused, I would ask the person who came to help us write up a formal complaint that said this organization is discriminating against us because we're deaf and they are not turning on captions, which it's required now. And then we would do a formal investigation where we would interview the respondent. And if we found for it, then we can find for it and they need to do it. If they refuse at that point, then it would go into the court system. And that's pretty rare. I mean, in 35 years of the Human Rights Commission, there's only been a couple cases that have ever elevated itself to the court things. Mostly it gets settled out of court.
Now, does that usually lead to enforcement automatically, or does it more often than not lead to a financial agreement?
It's really rare when there's a financial agreement. There can be sometimes. I doubt there would be in this particular kind of circumstances, but there are sometimes where somebody feels they've been discriminated against for their disability. They may be forced to move, and you know, we've got settlements where the moving expenses got paid for or things like that. So there's some recourse, but usually we find other ways to do it that don't involve money. But there are things like a restaurant didn't have ability for, they felt discriminated from by a restaurant, and they apologize and they give them some gift cards to come in and eat. So, you know, there are things like that have happened too.
What does the future hold for closed captioning here in Bloomington or in Indiana?
My hope is that we have a smooth rollout. We have plans to do, we're thinking about a decal that could be voluntarily put up on somebody's window. People might say, you know, oh, it's nice to know that you're closed captioning. You're more than welcome to put this on there if you'll make sure that your captions are on, and they can do that. We potentially could list them in websites on the, you know, the city, saying these are places that have closed captioning. I know that's just a possibility. We're discussing lots of different ways to do it. A key thing is just marketing and education, trying to get the word out that this is now an ordinance that they need to follow, and we'll go from there and see where it happens after we do it. But we are planning on trying to really figure out the best way to get the word out and get a lot of people educated and be prepared to talk to them and see where it goes.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's really been a pleasure talking with you. Anything further you'd like to mention just about what's next for closed captioning or accessibility?
No,
what's next?
I think that we're as far as we can go in terms of what's happening with closed captioning. Accessibility, we're working on a variety of different things in the community. We're looking at trying to get accessibility, transportation, and mobility principles passed. It's going to be in the comprehensive plan, hopefully to pass in the next month. That's kind of a big saying that you need to take people with disabilities into account for anything that's designed in the community so that it makes sure that it is accessible. We're working on that. We're working on trying to do a survey of people with disabilities to find out what their needs are in terms of housing and transportation. We do various events throughout the year to try to create more community awareness, and we're still doing a lot out there trying to help people with disabilities in terms of advocacy, and that's probably about all. But I do want to thank you very much, Abe, for letting me come over and talk to you about the closed captioning ordinance and all things accessibility, and appreciate your this show. So thank you for that.
And thank you, Michael Shermis. It was a pleasure. DisaBulletin is created and produced by me, Abe Shapiro. Our theme music is Baseball is More Than a Game by the George Romanis Sound. Abe Shapiro, WFHB News. Live and learn.